good evening, New Jersey family. Well, I can say that, can't I? We're all family. And in a very special sense, I consider New Jersey to be part of my family because I have relatives living downstate a little ways, down in Atlantic City. I won't get to see them this weekend because it's just a quick trip back here. But anyway, it's nice to be here. Well, we're going to be talking this weekend on a very unique subject entitled Omega 2. Now, if you're an Adventist these days and you're even half awake, you can't possibly have missed the sudden shift in world events that you have lived through over the past 5 years. Now, you just think, stop and think about some of the events that you've adjusted to over the last 5 years, just since I was at Camp Berkshire. You've seen the collapse of one of the most powerful empires that the world has ever seen. The Soviet Empire was a rival of the most powerful empires that have ever existed anywhere in the world. It all fell apart with hardly a shot fired. And then you remember about 5 years ago come summertime, something went wrong in the Persian Gulf. Remember that? Somebody got a little bit ambitious over there, thought he might just get a corner on one-third of the world oil supply. Do you remember what happened as soon as he did that? Almost mysteriously, the world united, didn't it? Just a couple of exceptions, but for all practical purposes, we were witnesses to see the whole world unite on a program. And they united because they were afraid. Well, you remember that wall that used to run across the middle of Berlin? I remember when the thing went up. I was a young newscaster at the time. I reported the erection of the Berlin Wall, like I reported the death of JFK and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And when that thing went up, none of us ever thought we would see it come down unless half of Europe was in flames. And yet we saw the Berlin Wall come down. And as soon as it did, what were our presidents and our news commentators all saying? We've now reached an era of peace and safety. You remember that? We even thought we'd have a peace dividend. We could maybe balance the federal budget. Read my lips. Interestingly enough, right after the Berlin Wall came down and people were talking about peace and safety, what happened to our world? I'll show you what happened to our world. It's right there on the cover of U.S. News from this week. There is no peace and safety in this world. Not in Sarajevo, not in the Horn of Africa, not in the subway system in crime-free Japan, and not in Oklahoma City. Something's happened in this world, and human decency and peace and safety have kind of gone through our fingers like so much sand. Now, isn't that a lot of change to adjust to? But there's something else that the perceptive Adventist will have noticed. It's headlines like this one from the newspaper that says, Catholics and Protestants sign pledge of unity. You seen headlines like that? Here's another one from my hometown newspaper out in California. Evangelicals reach out to Catholics. Here's another one from down in Texas, the Corpus Christi Caller Times. Baptist embrace ties with Catholics. And here's one from the San Bernardino Sun, from the Associated Press. I used to work with them when I was a newscaster. And it says, Catholics and evangelicals join hands. Say, wouldn't it be appropriate at this particular moment to read something from the Spirit of Prophecy? Let me read something to you from Volume 5, page 451 of Testimonies for the Church. When Protestantism shall stretch her hand across the gulf to grasp the hand of Roman power, then we may know the time has come for the marvelous working of Satan and that the end is near. Now, maybe I should show you a picture from my hometown newspaper. It's a little small. You're going to have to kind of focus your eyes to see this. But there is a color picture, a political cartoon of Uncle Sam wearing his top hat with all the stars and stripes on it, reaching across the Atlantic to shake hands with whom? An individual with a papal hat on his head. Now, let's go back to the spirit of prophecy. Great Controversy, page 599. The Protestants of the United States will be foremost in stretching their hand across the Gulf to clasp hands with Roman power. Well, I guess that lady was a plagiarist, wasn't she? Because she copied that. She copied it from my hometown newspaper in 1994. Well, if you're a perceptive Adventist, you can't have help noticing things like this. Time Magazine's Man of the Year. Now, something is happening in this world. You folk have figured that out. You don't need me to come in from California to tell you that. Something is happening in the world. What I want to point out to you, though, is that whenever history brews up this many changes, all in close proximity to each other, changes happening one after another and happening fast, you can bet on it you are on the brink of something very big. Some major change is going to occur. Well, our series this week is Omega 2, God's Church on the Brink. Now, we're not going to be looking at world events, as I oftentimes do in my weekend seminars. Instead, this weekend, we're going to focus on one very narrow area, but very important area for all of us to understand. And what we will be talking about is what is happening in the world of religion and what is happening inside the world of Adventism. And I'm going to take you behind the scenes, behind the curtains, and you're going to learn things that most people never dream have happened. You're going to see that the strange headlines we were just talking about a moment ago, about Protestant-Catholic reunification, may not be an accident. As a matter of fact, I think we will probably conclude that they are the result of a plan, a very brilliant plan laid something like 13 years ago by two of the foremost Jesuit thinkers in the 1980s. Brilliant individuals. Now, in our last session tomorrow evening, I'm going to share with you the plan to reunify all of Christianity and a plan to destroy Adventism. It may explain some of today's startling headlines, and it may help to explain what is happening inside Adventism today, so that when we finish this weekend, I think you won't have to wonder what's going on in this world or what is happening within our church. I think we will all know. So, let's begin. Now, our first topic is when Jesus tried to come. Now, as you look around the world at you tonight, it's quite evident that we are in an end-time world. It's obvious that the forces of history that are necessary to happen in order for the coming of Jesus to occur are already in place in our world. We can see them in Yokohama, in Oklahoma City. We can see them in Hackensack. Things are happening that make this an end-time world. But guess what, folks? This is not the first end-time world that Adventists have ever faced. Do you folk realize we've been here before? Exactly here. Matter of fact, back about 1895, we were getting close to the second coming. If God's people had been able to sense how energetically heaven was working, we would have seen the second coming probably occur shortly after the turn of the century. Back then, by the way, they had an interesting three-way presidential race. The country was in an economic slump. There were lots of homeless and hungry people roaming the country. The president who was running for re-election was very unpopular because of the bad economy. He was facing an individual who was a populist, who was able to say things that people liked to hear. And there was a third individual who joined that presidential race, who was a very wealthy man who said, hey, give me a chance at the White House and I'll straighten out the country's economic problems. Now, you change names like George Bush and Ross Perot to J.P. Morgan and Grover Cleveland, and you've got 1895 instead of 1990, whatever it was. We've been here before. We've been here at least twice. we almost saw the coming of Jesus just before the Civil War. There was a great revival in Adventism. In response to that revival, Ellen White said, "I saw angels commissioned to go everywhere in the world to prepare unbelieving hearts for truth." And you know what happened in the world of religion? Prayer meetings broke out spontaneously at noon in big commercial offices in places like New York City and Boston and Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. Historians to this day can't explain it. They don't know why it happened. They say it just bubbled up out of spontaneous Christian reaction to the world. They don't know why it happened. I can tell you why it happened. Ellen White explains it in Volume 1 of Testimonies for the Church. Jesus was trying to come. Now, it is in respect to that that Ellen White in Volume 1 said, "I saw slaves cast off their chains at the coming of Jesus." Now, some people have said, well, that proves she wasn't a prophet because the slaves were liberated by Abraham Lincoln, not by Jesus. But you know what she was doing? She was giving a conditional prophecy. If God's people held it together, the Civil War never needed to happen. The slaves would have been liberated by Jesus himself. We've been close before. Well, we're going to talk tonight about another time in which Adventism was very, very close to the Second Coming. We're going to watch as, at that exact moment, a terrible apostasy sweeps through the Church of God. It stops the church dead, momentarily dead in the water, just like a ship hitting an iceberg. And it delays the Second Coming for at least 9 terrible decades. Now, why are we going to go back and begin our series this weekend by looking backward at a time when God's people didn't serve his work as well as they should have? All that would only be history to perhaps be forgotten, except for the fact that in the middle of that crisis, Ellen White said something. She said, "This is the Alpha of apostasies. The Omega will come, and when it does, I tremble for you." Just before the coming of Jesus, she said, we will see the same thing happen all over again. We will be poised at an opportunity for the Second Coming. The devil will try to do exactly what he did back about 1905 and stop God's church. And she called that future challenge Omega. So let's go back for just a couple of minutes to a moment of sunlight, right at the turn of the century, time of peace and prosperity in this world, boundless optimism. On New Year's Day, 1900, on the surface, the world seemed wonderful. Financial recession had given way to a financial recovery, so that by the turn of the century, people were making money big time here in America. Now, that wouldn't last long. Within a couple or 3 years, a recession would come back called the banker's panic, and all that wealth would disappear. But for a little window of opportunity, there was a time of prosperity. At the same moment, something interesting happened in the world. Suddenly, peace broke out. And barriers that had been up there, preventing people from going out with missionary work all over the world, collapsed in some key areas of the world, so you could go anywhere with the gospel and you had momentarily enough money to do the job. Now you see how doors are opening? At the turn of the century, barriers mysteriously collapsed that had been there in the way of God's people before. Hey, does that sound familiar? What about the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Well, at times like that, it's kind of neat. You can just almost see heaven lining things up for God's people to get the work done, for Jesus to return, and for the war to be over. And so it was then. In America, events moved so far into an end-time mode that senators were openly proposing a national Sunday law. We've never been that close again. And across the world of Adventism, God's blessings were just lavished on the church. We had missionaries all over Europe. Ellen White had even been to Europe. As far out in the Pacific as a little lonely island called Pitcairn, a tiny little dot of land in the middle of a lot of salty nowhere, guess where the Adventist mission presence was? We had gone that far in the world. Well, in America, the work was prospering. Our publishing work now was growing to be a giant. We had the very best publishing house in the whole state of Michigan. The best presses in the whole state were owned by Adventists. And in Battle Creek, Michigan, there was that big hospital run by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. It was called Battle Creek Sanitarium. And guess what was happening there? Captains of industry like Henry Ford and Harvey Firestone, European royalty, and heads of state like presidents would come to Battle Creek Sanitarium because it was the best health care institution in the world. That was how God was blessing Adventism. Well, the only jarring note in that whole symphony of opportunity was, guess what? God's people themselves. History was readier for the second coming than were God's people themselves. If you looked carefully at the advice God had given as to how he wanted his work run, then you compared how the work was actually being managed and how people were living, it was very clear that God's people were on a departure course from the blueprint. For example, Ellen White said, "Don't stop and enjoy this peace and prosperity here at the turn of the century, because it isn't going to be here long. It's going to disappear, and very soon people will be working in vain to put business on a more secure basis." Remember that statement from Volume 9? Well, she was warning people, now's the time to put your efforts and your means into the work, because the prosperity you're enjoying simply won't be here long. Now, if God's people would heed that advice, they could soon bring on the second coming. If they ignored it, got distracted by the world, things would soon go bad. War would come. She said there will become on the world wars where human lives will be sacrificed by millions. Terrible new weapons will be invented, and our ability to go out, the safe passage of God's people to go out and do missionary work, will be hedged, as she put it, on the right hand and on the left. So do it now, or you're going to face real problems. Yet in the sunlight of history's last summer day, do you want to try to guess what God's people did? They did exactly what she advised them not to do. Ordinary lay people, like most of us, got caught up in the prosperity and the relatively easy life in America at the turn of the century, and they began to buy and sell real estate and mining stock and speculate. In other words, they came to believe that the only purpose for all this prosperity was to keep them happy, well-fed, and entertained. Battle Creek, Michigan got to be a byword all over the East Coast of the United States. From the Midwest all the way to the East Coast, people referred to Battle Creek, Michigan as the Adventist mining camp because it was so filled with real estate speculators. Now, the lay people weren't the only ones with a monopoly on this ability to listen to the spirit of prophecy and ignore what it told them to do. You know something? The brethren also found ways to ignore the spirit of prophecy. One classic example of that was Ellen White's urging the church, don't focus all your money here because there are mission fields out there which are desperately in need of funds. They don't have enough funds to do the work. You need to send the money out of Michigan and over to places in Africa and the South Pacific and the Far East where they really need the funds to get the work started. And yet nobody seemed to be listening. That big old hospital just kept on growing. For 1/5 of a mile down Washington Street in Battle Creek, Michigan, that huge institution kept growing and growing until it was filled with 1,000 employees who lost their sense of mission. They no longer thought of themselves as medical evangelists. They were just health professionals. That was just the beginning. What about the publishing work? The publishing work had begun one day back in New England with a young fellow by the name of James White picking up in a carpet bag the entire first edition of a little missionary paper called Present Truth. He didn't have any money, just as broke as can be, so he walked 15 miles to deliver that little magazine, that little flyer, to the post office. That's how our publishing work had begun. But by the turn of the century, our publishing work is growing into a giant. The best presses in Michigan, but what were they printing? They were beginning to print stuff that was so absolutely unrecognizable as Adventism that Ellen White was even worried about its effect on the workers in the press who would read the stuff while setting type. Now let's talk about education. Very soon, Adventist education would begin to face problems. At Battle Creek College, some of the faculty there were, at least by Ellen White's analysis, only half committed to Adventism. Some of them were very hostile to the spirit of prophecy. Some of them didn't even understand Adventism themselves. And some of them were so antagonistic to it that wherever they got the chance, they would inject into students' minds doubts about things like the spirit of prophecy, the unique doctrines of the church, and what we ought to be doing in this world. As a result, she said, students would graduate from Battle Creek College not having the foggiest idea what it really meant to be an Adventist. By 1906 or 7, she is receiving letters from anguished parents saying, "I sent my child to an Adventist college and he lost his soul there. What's going on?" Well, let's cut to the chase here. What's the point we're making? When you see a situation like this developing within the church, you have a crisis coming. You're on the brink of something. Ellen White, in this era, warns the church, get your act together soon or you're going to lose the best chance you have to see Jesus in your lifetime. Let me read it to you from Evangelism, page 696. "We may have to remain here in this world because of insubordination many more years, as did the children of Israel. But for Christ's sake, his people should not add sin to sin by charging God with the consequence of their own wrong course of action." What she's saying is, keep this up, folk, and you're going to be a long time in this world you think you love. In a situation like that, you can see it coming like a freight train. God is going to send a wake-up call to his church. Something is going to go wrong. And now let's go back and pick the story up where God tries to wake up Adventism. On February 18, 1902, just 2 years into the new century, in the cold pre-dawn hours of a winter morning, the alarm gong went off inside the brick and stone arches of the Battle Creek Fire Department. And firemen rolled out of bed and tumbled into those firefighting suits and went down the pole and got on the big pump engine while somebody harnessed up the pump horses. And very soon that big machine clattered out over the cobblestones and headed down Washington Street. You know why? Because Battle Creek Sanitarium, the pride and joy of Adventism, was burning to the ground. Now, the firemen got busy. They started pumping water into the thing, but the water seemed to have no effect. One fireman would later say, "There's something strange about your Adventist fires," because there was going to be more than one in Battle Creek. He said, "When we put the water on, it's like we're putting on gasoline. It doesn't seem to do anything." Well, the firemen worked hard because that was the biggest and best building in all of Battle Creek, but they weren't successful. And by morning, the sanitarium was just a pile of charcoal steaming beneath a pale winter sunrise. Now, Mrs. White reacted as soon as she got the news, and she said, "Today we received the sad news." And she wrote in a tone that didn't have any hint of self-righteous "I told you so's." See, for her, the work of God was still the work of God, and a church institution was still precious even when it had departed from God's ideal. So she said, "We received the sad news, and I would at this time speak words of wisdom, but what can I say? We are afflicted with those whose life interests are bound up in this institution. We can indeed weep with those who weep." Now that's a Christ-like attitude, isn't it? Maybe they're wrong, and maybe God had to let the thing burn down because they were wrong, but she still identified with God's people. Now, however big the damage was, and it was enormous, it set our medical work back terribly, there was a silver lining to the cloud. And here's what the silver lining was. You know, as long as that big institution stood there, it was the single best argument against doing what Ellen White said we ought to do. Now, what did she say we ought to do? Tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about God's ideal and His plan for Adventism. And we're going to ask ourselves, are there any ways we personally or institutionally can maybe get closer to God's blueprint for our work? But one of the ideals God had was not building these big urban institutions for a lot of good reasons we're going to talk about tomorrow morning. He said instead, scatter a lot of little institutions out in the country where you're more apt to reach the common people. You get one institution here, those who can afford to come there will hear the Advent message, but what about the people that can't afford? Why not take the message to them? So, she had been urging us to establish a lot of small rural health institutions, and the biggest argument against her advice was, well, look, there's Battle Creek Sand. We're not going to be able to move the thing, so why don't we just quit worrying about the issue? Well, when the sanitarium burned down, guess what? The argument burned down with it. Now Ellen White says we have a chance to go back and get on track. It's not too late. It's 1902. Very soon the banker's panic will come along, the recession will come along, but there is still a slim chance God's people can put it together and they can see Jesus come in their lifetime. If they'll make the correction they need to make and get back with God's ideal. So you see, the brethren who are going to decide this issue are now at one of those invisible forks in a road. You ever come in your lifetime to a point where you can almost see the road divide? Do I do this or do I do that? Do I marry this gal or that gal? When I was in college, there was a fellow who had been dating two girls. And he was really genuinely confused. Lord, which one shall I marry? He didn't know. So he prayed. He said, Lord, the one that I'm supposed to marry, let her come down the sidewalk tomorrow morning and give me a particular greeting, like, hi, how you doing? Guess what happened? Both of them came down the sidewalk. They both saw him at the same time. They both said the same thing. Well, he was at a fork in the road, right? The brethren back in 1902 were at a fork in the road. They had to make a decision. Now, the decision is, are we really going to follow God's advice for this church, even though it may not make business sense, even though it'll make some people angry at us, like John Harvey Kellogg, this powerful, world-famous doctor who's synonymous with Battle Creek Sanitarium? Or will they stand on principle? See, do you compromise or do you follow principle? Well, it's been said that aviation is 99% boredom and 1% stark terror. And I think that's about right. Most of the time, flying an airplane is really quite dull. It's boring. But once in a while, you get a wake-up call. And I think maybe some variant of that little saying can apply to the brethren who are responsible for leading our church. Once in a while, an issue comes along, brethren, that is worth everything, including the risk of your career. You are paid to recognize principle. And when it comes along and you face it, it's worth everything, including the risk of your career, to stand for principle. And when you fail the Lord, it's a terrible thing to do. Now, that's what made this mysterious, invisible crossroads so important, you see. The brethren are at a crossroads. I mean, true, the work had been damaged in a fire wanted by nobody, least of all by Ellen White, but there's still a chance to turn things around. There is still time. You still could maybe create that little chain of rural health care institutions that the Lord, through His messenger, is saying, I need to have for my work. Now, stop a second and ask a question. Just supposing back then the brethren had made the decision they're going to ignore what seems to be conventional wisdom, they're going to ignore political pressure, and instead this time they're going to act on faith. And they had created those little rural healthcare institutions scattered throughout the country, the Deep South, the Middle States, the Atlantic Seaboard, and they had gone one step further and adopted the plan God had for His work. That is to say, nobody in this team is more important than anybody else. Just because a doctor has technical skills that takes some schooling to acquire doesn't mean he's much different from a minister who also has technical skills that needs some time to get schooled into. So you're all part of the team. Nobody's more important than anybody else, and nobody gets paid any more than anybody else. See? The Lord had a plan where everybody was an evangelist. That was their job. Some people evangelized from up here in the pulpit, and some people evangelized in the examining room of a medical institution, but evangelism was their job, and what they did for a living was just the vehicle to get there. See? Now, if we had followed the plan, small, inexpensive, plain but serviceable institutions with everybody working for a ministerial wage, guess what would be happening in America today if time had lasted this long? Do you suppose some good people down in Washington, D.C., in a federal department called Health and Human Services, might be beating on the door of the General Conference saying, "Tell us how you do it, folks, because we can't figure it out"? I mean, Hillary Rodham Clinton would have had somebody to go to who had some advice worth listening to. Okay? Well, the brethren have that decision to make. In other words, the brethren could choose either to compromise or to act on faith. You ever heard the term righteousness by faith? Isn't that talked about a lot these days? We hear it all the time. Much has been said about the need for righteousness by faith. Here was a chance for the leaders of our church to act out the idea. You know, faith, after all, is what? It's nothing more than trusting God enough to follow His advice, right? Isn't that faith? Isn't that a pretty good definition for it? I mean, congregations are told, you got to exercise faith. New converts come into this church, they have to exercise faith enough sometimes to trade a job for the Sabbath, don't they? Or maybe to risk family relationships over the Sabbath. Tithe is paid even when the bank account's getting pretty thin. Why? Because we believe that we ought to be honest with the Lord and trust Him to take care of us, right? Now, here the brethren were facing an issue where the wrong decision could send a very confusing message to the people in the pews. Why trust the Lord with your soul when you can't even trust Him to pick out the right location for a hospital? That's the issue they're facing. So there was still a little bit of time, not much, but perhaps just enough to put things back together so that God's work could be finished before a lot of nightmares came down over an unsuspecting early 20th century world. Well, let me ask you a question, not to prolong this too long tonight. Let's just quickly move to the question. Guess what the brethren did? You want to guess? I'll give you a clue. We're still in this world 90 years later. So what do you think they did? The brethren decided to compromise. Keep it small, John Harvey Kellogg. Don't make it too big. Just 450 feet long and 5 stories high. Can you keep it to that? Oh, yes, brethren, I can keep it to that. Of course, later on that summer, after they voted this building, they discovered the foundation footings were 100 feet longer than they were supposed to be, and 3 wings were coming off the back of the building. So guess what the brethren now have to face? They've got a full-blown financial crisis. Now, do you see how this thing kind of works like a spiral? You make the wrong decision on what seems to be relatively unimportant thing, like do we rebuild a hospital or don't we? That's not going to mean the end of the world, is it? Just maybe it is. Because now the church brethren, you see, face not only the problem that they've not followed God's plan and the way He wants His health care work done, now they got a financial crisis. I mean, Kellogg has 5 acres of marble floors there put in by the same workman who put in the floors in the Library of Congress. I mean, Kellogg has one thing. He's got good taste. Just doesn't have the budget to support it. And the church has to pay the bill. Okay, brethren, are now beginning to learn an important lesson called cause and effect. You make a mistake here, and it's going to lead you increasingly to places where you're going to make more and more mistakes. Well, they're in trouble. They don't have enough money to pay for this big thing. So the president of the General Conference, a good, godly man whom Ellen White solidly stood with, nonetheless exercised his human judgment. Now, he's going to save the church. I got it all figured out. We need a little money. John Kellogg, you're a very famous doctor. People like to hear you speak and they like to read your books. Would you write a book on health?
will sell it to the American public and donate the proceeds to help rebuild Battle Creek Sanitarium. Kellogg says, I'd love to do it. No problem at all. He got busy. This guy was a dynamo. He would dictate from the moment he got up. When he got in the bathtub, he had a male secretary who, despite the distracting circumstances, seems to have been able to transcribe his dictation. He dictated from the bathtub, from the train, from a bicycle to a secretary racing alongside. And in record time, he had his book produced. It was called The Living Temple. And you know what was in it? Dr. Kellogg was playing with a funny idea. For several years now, Kellogg had been saying, you know, I wonder about this being we call God. You know, we sing about him, we pray to him every Sabbath there in the Dime Tabernacle in Battle Creek, but who is he really? Is he really a person someplace off in a place called heaven? Or is there another possibility that God is in fact a force, an intelligence that pervades all of nature? That God's presence can be found in everything that He's created. Does that idea sound at all familiar to you folk today? You ever heard of something called New Age? What Dr. John Harvey Kellogg had bumped into in the spring of 1902, 1903 was something called New Age. Didn't have that name then, but that's exactly what it was. Kellogg was dabbling with something called mysticism. And mysticism is an attempt found in many, many primitive and Eastern religions to fuse one's mind with the mind of God. Frequently it's done in trance-like meditation. We'll talk a little more about that before the weekend's over. Because that monster can also try to climb into Christianity posing as Christian meditation. Very dangerous. Ellen White says when you get that far, you're reaching a point where evil angels can talk to you. You've opened a door in your head. So that's what Kellogg's dabbling with. And guess what gets into the first 30 or 40 pages of his book? This concept of mysticism. Now the church has progressed from a crisis over whether to rebuild a sanitarium that the Lord swept out of the way to a financial crisis. Now it escalates to a crisis in doctrine. See, the problem with Kellogg's thing is that if God is everywhere, if He's in this pulpit, if He's in me, if He's in the grass growing outside on the lawns here, then where, pray tell, is this thing called the heavenly sanctuary where we always thought God was? You see the problem? You get confused on the personality of God, and pretty soon you have undermined something called the heavenly sanctuary. Now, what's dangerous about that? Folk, you ain't going to understand the gospel unless you understand the sanctuary. We'll talk more about that later in this weekend. When you attack the sanctuary, what you've automatically done is you have attacked the whole reason for the existence of Seventh-day Adventism. Without the sanctuary, we have absolutely nothing unique. We share the Sabbath with other churches, don't we? The health message we share with some. The concept of an end-time prophet others have imitated. Most people, most Christians talk about the Advent now. You can find that on the cover of U.S. News. Last December it was there. But the sanctuary is unique. That's us. Dr. Kellogg, I don't think really understanding exactly what he was doing, had attacked the doctrine of the heavenly sanctuary. So now this becomes a terrible issue in the church. So what happens now is the church has to decide, this book that the General Conference President has commissioned to be written, should we even print the thing? Well, in 1902, in the fall, in the Autumn Council, they met, and guess what happened? They decided, finally, they're going to follow faith. Bless their hearts, the brethren can make mistakes just like we can. And if we'd been back there, we could have dropped the ball just the same way. But at least they recognized the onset of a bigger problem. They said, enough's enough. We're going to finally trust the Lord. So they were essentially saying to the Review and Herald, you cannot publish Dr. Kellogg's book. Well, at this point, Dr. Kellogg probably should have thought a little bit, don't you think? When you get direction from your brethren in the church, you should think about it. Maybe they're right, maybe I'm wrong. But at this point, Dr. Kellogg had lost the capacity to follow his brethren. He got to thinking, wait a second, the Review and Herald, doesn't just print denominational books. They've been printing outside stuff. And they had. They had been printing stuff on spiritualism. Just to make money. It was a good source of income for the press. So down Washington Street went an inquiry. Would you like to accept an order for 5,000 copies of my book, Living Temple? Do it as a job printing operation here. It's not denominational. Just charge the job to John Harvey Kellogg, M.D. And guess what the leaders of the review said? Yes, sir. Now, the year is waning. It's getting toward December. The type is set. The plates are made. In the press room, piles of fresh, clean paper wait for the bite of that big steam press. And in a little valley out in California, just down the hill from something called St. Helena Sanitarium, Ellen White is troubled night after night after night. She says, I see visions in the visions of the night, an angel with a sword as of fire extended over Battle Creek. Something else is going to happen. Well, right toward the end of the year, something else happened. It was the night of December 30, 1902. Elder Daniels, president of the General Conference, was in his office. He was working late. About 7:30, down Washington Street floated the sound of the Dime Tabernacle church bell ringing, inviting people to come to prayer meeting. And probably Daniels picked his pocket watch up and opened it up and looked at it, just confirmed that the time was 7:30. If he did, that was the last routine act he performed that night. Because moments later, the lights went out. The power supply for that section of the city of Battle Creek had failed. And in through his office window came a reddish glow that was unmistakable to anybody who had seen the sanitarium burn down. Another fire was raging across the street. This time, it was the Review and Herald. Well, Daniels and his associate rushed out the door. By the time they got there, the whole building was just exploding with flame. It was a furious sight, broken by periodic explosions. As offices would superheat, they'd explode. The window glass had come screaming out onto the street. Here are shouting firemen, there are clanking pump engines. Once again, those straining arcs of water are trying to put out a fire that only seems to feed on water. And from time to time, you could hear the crash of heavy machinery as the best presses in Michigan tumble down as floors burn through and crash broken into the inferno below. Within about an hour, it was all over. The Review and Herald publishing house was gone. It was nothing but a pile of charcoal and scattered brick, with broken Adventist presses lying among the melted plates of Kellogg's book, Living Temple. Within one devastating year, two major institutions of the Seventh-day Adventist Church had disappeared in smoke. And I want to close by simply saying that there was a lesson here for people who call themselves the remnant. The lesson posed as a question. It was purchased at the cost of two institutions. And the question was simply this. Would God's people finally learn to follow God's plan for running His church? And tomorrow morning, our topic will be God's plan for Adventism. And we will ask ourselves a question, first of all, and most importantly, personally, are we today following His plan, or is there room to get back on track?
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.